So in science, you need to have creativity, but you also need to have a big framework. And Greg Stevens is very keen on that. It's like he starts asking you step by step, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? And then you have to have an answer for each one of those steps. And if you don't, then you have to go back to the drawing board. So rigor is a very important thing that I learned from him.
You're listening to the Class Acts podcast, an initiative of UCD Conway Institute, a research institute based in University College Dublin. My name is Elaine Quinn. In this podcast series, we want to introduce you to scientists at the heart of fascinating new research here in the Institute. What motivated our researchers to pursue a career in science? What journeys have they taken along their career path? What areas of research are they pursuing? How have their careers been influenced by mentorship along the way? Some of these scientists have long established research groups in the Institute, while others have just begun to build their own teams here in UCD. All of them have spoken about their work in our weekly Conway Lecture and Seminar Series, or CLASS for short. Our host is Dr. Owen Cummins, Assistant Professor of Physiology in UCD School of Medicine and a Conway Fellow. Owen leads a research group studying how carbon dioxide and oxygen affect cellular behaviour. Owen is also passionate about educating the next generation of scientists and medics and actively contributes to equality, diversity and inclusion initiatives within UCD. He was inspired to create the Class Acts podcast to share the many and varied backgrounds and journeys taken by Conway researchers on their routes to scientific success. In episode 4, Dr. Owen Cummins talks with Assistant Professor Sergio Rey from UCD School of Medicine, who is a Conway Fellow. Sergio describes how he trained as a clinician scientist in Chile before perseverance and hard work led him to a Nobel Prize-winning laboratory in Johns Hopkins University. Sergio's interest in hypoxia and cancer led him to Dublin via Canada, where he is excited about the next chapter in his research career as an Ad Astra Fellow.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to today's podcast. We're joined by Assistant Professor Sergio Rey from the School of Medicine, a recent Ad Astra Fellow. How are you doing this morning?
Doing pretty well, Owen. Thank you for the invitation.
We'll start off probably bringing you back a few years to your childhood growing up in Chile. I'm just wondering, what was the inspiration behind you pursuing a career in medicine, as it was at that time? Back in the good old days.
Right. You're not going to ask me about my mother or anything like that, right?
This is not a psychotherapy session
or something.
You are in a safe place, but it's
How
not a psychotherapy
you you
session.
No, yeah. Well, actually, it's funny because it's. I would say that my interest in science goes as back as I can remember. I was lucky enough to have a family, a mother and a father that were very supportive of this. Apparently, I was very curious since I was a kid. I started reading very early, and apparently, I was always taking things apart. I think that this is a common theme among scientists in general. I was interested in astronomy and in space. And then when I was like about 10 years old, I was like kind of bubbling, like blubbering about planets and moons and stuff like that. So my parents caught on that, and they kind of stimulated that. So that was definitely something good for me. Then you know, the transition to sciences continued in elementary, middle, and high school. I was always interested in physics and chemistry and biology and those things, math. And so the natural step was to look for something that had a heavy science base. You know what I mean? So sure. Medicine. My dad was a very pragmatic man, so he told me, well, why don't you get a medical degree first, and then if you continue with this craziness of being a scientist, you can always pivot some way, you know. So
yeah,
I thought
sure.
that it was
you have the security of the professional qualification.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a good advice, so I did that. And fortunately, I got into a pretty competitive school there in Santiago, in Chile, which is my home country. And I went to medical school there, and I got exposure to disease, you know, to physiology, to all of those things that came to be very handy later on in my career without actually planning for it.
Did you feel at that stage that you were more likely to go down the medical route or the surgical route or a scientific route, or were you still open to opportunities at that point?
Well, the thing is that when I was in medical school, I tended to get in trouble because I was the one who was always, so I was asking, but why do we get this drug? Why this one and why not this other one? And why do we change it if this happens? And most of the time, you know, the answers, as you know, in medicine are pretty much empirical. Basically, the answer is there is a clinical trial that found that this drug was superior to this other, or we do this because otherwise this other thing happens. And when you ask, you know, the ultimate mechanism at the molecular level of why something happens, like going down to the tiny bits of cells and tissues, and, you know, like the real machinery, the kind of thing that interests me when I was a kid, sure. It was not really there most of the time. And so I had like a voice in the back of my head that still talks to me. No, not the type of voice. That was telling me that I was going to end up, you know, going into the science route. But I got interested because I found out that there were many things that needed treatments that they could be improved. And maybe I thought, well, maybe if I'm lucky enough to discover something useful that could actually help people. So I didn't really abandon the interest for the clinic because I actually enjoyed the clinical work a lot. I enjoy working with people and trying to help. That's always pleasant for me. But the science kind of pulled me a little bit further into that direction. And that's how I, instead of going into neurology, I was interested in neurology and psychiatry as a resident. There was this opportunity that appeared in my school, a new program that was launched for an MD PhD program. And I decided to go that way.
So the desire to go deeper, to search for some of that cellular empirical evidence and mm-hmm. sort of dovetail that with the clinical medical element was the passion behind mm-hmm. going for an MD PhD program. So what was involved with that? So did you do lab rotations, or were you paired up to a mentor straight away?
When I was in the second year of medical school, there was a professor that offered us opportunity. Said, well, if you're interested in this, and funnily enough, it was related with the sensing of oxygen in the body, which is basically the underlying theme to all my research and my interest. So, but this was from the point of view of how your body senses when there is a lack of oxygen and how that controls respiration and blood pressure and things like that. So, and he was working on that. And he said, if anybody's interested in coming to my lab and maybe checking out things, it was very informal. So like a week later, I knocked on his door and he was very gracious. He was very inspirational to me. And actually what I did is I spent 3 or 4 summers pro bono doing experiments there. I started, you know, adjusting solutions, cleaning up the floor, washing beakers, things like that. And slowly I started doing things that were more sophisticated. And a couple of years later, I got my first paper. And I think that got me hooked up. The first time that I saw my name in a paper and I said, wow, did I really do this? It was like a high, like almost like a drug high. It's this rush of adrenaline and happiness. Oh, look, I did this. And I got hooked. And then I did rotations. There were opportunities, and I was always coming back to this lab. Then I went to another lab that was working in Alzheimer's. And instead of going on vacation, basically, I was spending my summers doing experiments. Sometimes I would drag my friends from medical school because it would be useful for credits later on to get into a residency, right? So I had a friend that was basically sleeping on the corner of the lab, you know, against a chair against the wall. And in the meantime, I was doing experiments. They say, yeah, well, but we're in this together, right? So of course we would. We would share the credit. It was fun.
Yeah, it sounds like a great way to do a sort of a scientific apprenticeship whilst doing your medical studies. Is that something you would recommend to current medical students to try and get exposure to different laboratories as they move through?
Yeah, I think that it's important to, before you commit yourself to a formal program, it is important to get a taste on whether you are you are made to work in the in that type of environment. Because, you know, sometimes in your own theory, it sounds very interesting, but, you know, there is a thing of personality or skin or taste. You have to have the taste for the thing, because, you know how, as you know, as a researcher yourself, you know that that most of the time, most of the experiments don't work. Most of the times, what you think is the explanation for what's going to happen doesn't happen. And everything is, I mean, I always say, you know, the cells always do whatever they want. So it's like, you know, you think, oh, this is going to be such a great discovery. And it's totally different from what you expect. So you have to learn to cope with this frustration, quote unquote, and say, you know, okay, well, let's figure out what's going on here. And hence, you know, the desire to do that has to be part of your personality. And you have to see if that works well. And also working in a team, working with other people, all of that, you know, it's important. You know,
I totally agree. Science is a great leveler. So you come up with these lofty ideals and convince yourself you're incredibly intelligent and have figured out exactly how things are going to work. And then, as you say, lo and behold, the experiment will
it's a humbling
most often give you. It is humbling, but I think it's important, because it's from that that you learn that not to expect to understand everything straight away, and to listen to the data and to. Follow the experiment and keep testing, and that's what brings you forward.
Yeah, it's good to keep your ego in check.
Definitely,
you get slapped back by the cells. No,
it definitely.
No, you fool.
There is no more grounding a career, I think, than a career in science. Mm-hmm. So after what, four and a half years of doing a PhD in Chile, where was the next destination for you?
Oh, well, that was fun, because, you know, then I got a job and in the Department of Nephrology in my school. I convinced someone that hypoxia, which is what I do, low oxygen, was very important in the function of the kidneys. And then, you know, I became like an instructor there. And so I was teaching some stuff, you know, doing some work. And the plan was to start, you know, setting up a lab or something. But then, of course, I said, well, you know, I would need to pursue postdoctoral studies. And that was a long search. It took a while. So I probably sent I wanted to go to the States. No particular reason. I guess I was unoriginal in that sense. To say, okay, I have to go to the States.
There are lots of opportunities there. And there's some good labs as well. So
probably every state got at least one letter from me. that's my style. So basically, I knock on your door, and until you open, you don't get rid of me. I'm a pest. So basically, of course, I was doing my thesis. My thesis was in hypoxia. I was in low oxygen and how it acts in the physiological context. That is, in the context of healthy tissues, right? Of what happens in a healthy person. But this name was coming back, you know, Semenza, right? Greg Semenza. Who is this guy? So I started, you know, reading about his papers, and I started asking. And one of my friends actually went to a lab to do a rotation over there in Philadelphia with a collaborator of Greg Semenza. And I thought, okay, you know, and he told me he's great. So he's great. I mean, this guy, of course, I read the papers about all this important research that he did. And I thought, okay, I gotta go to that guy. I gotta get in there. So I sent him an email, and I didn't get an answer. And I sent another email, and I didn't get an answer. And suddenly, after a few, probably they went through a spam folder. I mean, a person like that, you know, I guess gets thousands of emails like this per day. I was just trying, you know. I didn't really expect who's going to listen to this kid from Chile, you know, who is like a doctor and, you know, who worked in, you know, some obscure oxygen sensor in the neck, which is what I did. I thought that it was important what I did. I published seven papers from my thesis. But anyway, I was very proud of it. But I knew that it was a very small field, you know what I mean? So
yes.
I didn't expect really an answer. And he said, well, you know, let's see. I mean, what are your interests? And long story short, he said no a couple of times more. and at the end, you know, I got funding from my own funds and you know, some small grants from the government of Chile. I got an award from the president of Chile. Actually, it was a small stipend that helped me a lot. And then I came back to him and said, "Well, now I have money." And he said, He said, okay, you know what? You know, I surrender. He said, you come here. And he always says that, he tells that anecdote about me that you know, I never give up. I guess that that's one of the things that if you know me personally, you would notice that I insist until I get things done and I never give up. I'm a little bit stubborn, more than
a little. I think it's a characteristic that can be very important for a career in science, and it was obviously very influential in getting you into the lab that you ended up in. So for those listeners who don't know who Greg Semenza is, so this is the man that Sergio was knocking on his door. So Greg was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology for his great discoveries relation to oxygen sensing in 2019. So when you were knocking on his door, so this was prior to prior to the winning of the Nobel Prize, but Greg Semenza's lab was still very much at the forefront of all research relating to hypoxia, was beginning to become interested in research in hypoxia relating to cancer research also.
So you got at that point he was not he won this barrage of awards a few years when I was already out of the lab. So imagine the luck of that. I mean, I never foresaw that. It was like, okay, that's lucky, and that's another thing that you need to have sometimes in life, right? A little bit of luck. So that was good.
So it must have been really exciting as well as challenging environment to go into such a high profile lab, really working at the forefront of discoveries in relation to oxygen sensing. So how did you find that experience in the States? Was it very different to your experience prior to that in Chile? And what sort of characteristics do you think maybe the lab had that made it so successful that you could learn and maybe take some lessons into your own lab going forward?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a very good question. I was terrified when I got in there. I was terrified because, I mean, of course at the beginning, I guess I didn't know, I didn't measure up really the how big Greg Semenza was in the field. I just knew that what he discovered was very important because nephrology, you know, and it turns out that the story of what he discovered has to do with how you produce more red blood cells once you are low on oxygen, right? And that was a mystery in medicine for a long time, and he discovered how that happened. So I knew that was huge from the point of view of the function of the body. Then I started reading more and more. And after he accepted me in the lab, I started reading everything that he published. And then I got terrified. I guess I said, oh my God, you know, this guy is brilliant. I mean, I'm not cut out for this, you know. The thing is that the training in Chile, in medical sciences, the medical school where I went, the Catholic University of Chile, was it's an excellent school. It's considered to be one of the best in South America by all metrics, taken for what it's worth. And my mentor in Chile was Dr. Iturriaga. He was a great guy in the sense that he helped me become a scientist. He helped me to think about problems in a way in which you look at them from what people call basic first principles, right? You look at the problem from let's pick it apart and try to simplify it as much as we can. That helped me a lot because when I got to Greg Semenza's lab, you know, I realized that rigor was the most important thing by far. I already knew it. Being precise in what you're looking at for why you're looking at a certain problem and why are you using this technique or that technique? Why am I looking at this thing in this way and not this other way? It's not like something random, like an artist, right? I imagine an artist comes with a melody or a symphony, and it comes from kind of like a free association of ideas. This is what I get. So in science, you need to have creativity, but you also need to have a big framework. And Greg Semenza is very keen on that. It's like he starts asking you, you know, I mean, step by step, why are you doing this? And why are you doing that? And why are you doing this? And why is that? And why is this? And then you have to have an answer for each one of those steps. And if you don't, then you have to go back to the drawing board. So rigor is a very important thing that I learned from him. And working really hard, that's the biggest difference. I mean, you know, working evenings, nights, mornings, weekends, holidays, New Year's Eve, you had people in the lab at any time. I had a particular friend that was always, you know, I was always, I'm a night owl, so I always worked very late. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. Hey, what's up? You know, and I'm doing this experiment, and you know, this thing of always. Another thing that I learned is, you know, being really open about what you're doing. It's very good because sometimes, you know, you have a problem with an experiment. You go say, hey, you know what? I have a problem with this experiment. And you never know who's going to have the answer. And sometimes it can be a student. It can be anybody. Hey, have you tried this? And then you blank, you get the light bulb going off. Said,
sure.
How am I of an idiot? I have been an idiot. I didn't think of that, you know, and a very, very, very tough schedule. And Hopkins is a huge institution. There's lots of people. And it's a very collegial place. So I learned that it's very important not to isolate yourself and share your ideas, not being afraid. Sometimes in science, people are afraid that if you share your ideas, somebody might steal it from you. But you know what? You know, I think out of this way, this way. Okay, if it's something that it was going to advance your career greatly, and somebody else steals it, I guess if it's something that's worth a Nobel Prize, whatever that is, you know, probably it might be a problem. But if somebody takes it and then you realize that, you know, you were right all along, it confirms what you did. It's an independent confirmation.
It's better than being ignored in some cases.
Yes,
there are probably some examples where, you know, with proprietary compounds or novel technologies, maybe you need to have to be particularly careful. But I totally different. Agree. I think openness and, as you said, discussion with all sorts of people about different ideas can help build your research framework. I'm interested in the schedule as you described it in John Hopkins. So what do you think caused or motivated people to work so hard there? Was that coming from the top? Was that something that was expected in a high performing lab, or was it as a consequence of creating an environment where people wanted to succeed and that they were willing to go to the next level to in terms of the errors that they would put in to try and make a discovery?
No, it definitely didn't come from the top. It's not. I don't think that works. When you just impose and say, you have to be rigorous, you have to be smart, or you have to work hard. You cannot do that. I think that a place like Hopkins attracts people that are very ambitious and competitive and hardworking, and in general, people that have good qualifications to start with. But of course, the environment, you know, of people, you see everybody. I mean, we are apes, right? So we are imitators by definition. You know, we learn by imitating. When you're a kid, you learn by imitating. This is the same thing. If you have an environment where you see someone that is super motivated, super driven, and you see that person is getting results, obviously you tend to copy that. So I think that it's a point of creating the right environment, and also, of course, creating the time and the space to let those things happen. In other words, you need to have one of the things that you see in, at Hopkins is that, you know, many of the researchers are working 100% on research. Yes. That definitely makes a huge difference because, you know, otherwise you need to compartmentalize your life into other aspects. Like if you're doing administrative work, for example, that thing is a lot of work. So it takes from the research. So if you have that and you have people, lots of postdocs, for example, there were lots of postdocs. If you have a high ratio of postdocs in your mixture, those people drive the students and drive the other people to, let's do more research, more discussion. They self-organize. It's kind of like a self-organizing thing, you know?
So it's a research conducive ecosystem with highly motivated and talented people at the top, and then at every level along the way, supports and people with knowledge and people willing to help and support students.
And the open environment, right? So I just remember there's a phrase from Carl Sagan, I believe. He said, you know, that doing research, when you make a discovery, is like being in love. When you're in love, you want to tell the world that you're in love. So I think it's the same thing. You make a discovery, you know, you need to tell the other guys that are in, and if there are a lot of people that are interested in what you're doing and lots of collaborations, so obviously these people are going to be interested in feeding your idea and maybe amplifying it to a new level. You know what I mean?
So the love grows.
Right. Everybody loves the idea even more. And at the end, it doesn't matter. I mean, that's how you end up with these papers that have 100 authors, you know? It's like, you know, everybody's putting a little bit of another raisin on the cake, on the pie, or whatever.
And that's the beauty of multidisciplinarity as well, is the fact that, you know, additional contributions, maybe relatively minor from one or two individuals, can significantly enhance your own publication because they allow you to ask a question or to mm-hmm. test something that mm-hmm. you wouldn't maybe able to do by yourself, or at least not easily.
Also, you have to make sure that you're in charge of the thing, because once you have too many people, that's another thing that can happen. There can be like a little bit of power struggles between the bigger personalities in the group, you see. So it also teaches you how to handle that, which is super important I think it's important as a skill later on, right? When you try to build your own group or something like that.
Absolutely. I think the ability to have a focused approach to delivering on a study is really important. And you know, if there are multiple contributors, to have that sort of chain of command, or at least, you know, some sort of hierarchy where everybody knows their own role within the study.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a really exciting and productive time for you while you were in the States. So what was your next destination after that? You went north of the border. We're moving from North America, or am I missing something along the way?
Yeah, I think that I forgot to tell you something. You know, yeah, then which is not a minor thing. So during my research with Greg Semenza, I was focused on vascular biology and started evolving slowly. The paper started moving towards cancer, right? Because, you know, as you know, the blood vessels that feed a tumor, that give nutrition to a tumor, are regulated by the oxygen level. So the less oxygen you have, the tumor is capable of stimulating the tissue to give more blood flow to the tumors, feed the tumor. And in other words, it's like selfishly taking up the blood flow. So that thing is regulated by hypoxia. And I started collaborating with people in the lab. So it goes back to what we were talking just a minute ago. And I got very interested on this. And, you know, it turns out that Greg was also moving in the direction of cancer. And then I said, I applied the same principle that I did before. Say, okay, who is someone that is really doing cutting edge thing here in cancer? And there was at Hopkins, you have Bert Vogelstein, who is also, I wouldn't be surprised if he won a Nobel Prize, but he has won all the other awards besides that. So that was like, he's like a celebrity over there. So I applied the same principle. Obviously, I thought that he was going to say no, and I started insisting again. But this time I could literally physically knock on his door, right? And he's a great guy. So after a while, you know, he accepted me for a second postdoctoral stay in his lab, which is a huge lab. It's like a lab that has probably 100 people.
And wow.
Yeah, it's like a huge lab. And he had this project that was with a company. So we had funding from a company to test a bacterium that was capable of migrating into the hypoxic regions of a tumor, the parts of the tumor that have less oxygen, and kind of eat the tumor alive from inside. And this was an engineered bacteria. So I never worked with bacteria. And of course, it sounded very challenging to me. I said, you want this? And I said, yeah, okay. And I did it. And I worked for a couple of years, actually almost 2 years over there. And we managed to improve the effectiveness of that bacterium. Of course, that part is proprietary, so I cannot tell you what we found. Otherwise,
One of the examples where we don't share.
Yes, otherwise,
at least not on a podcast that's going around the world. So I don't think Bert Vogelstein would be too happy about that.
But it would be very unfair if I didn't mention him, because he was great and I learned a lot from him as well. So I had been very lucky of actually working with two people that were so prestigious and
very high profile mentors, to be sure.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that was unbelievably lucky. So I'm very grateful for that. And then, of course, like you said, then I found a job in Canada, and I moved to the Princess Margaret Cancer Center in Toronto, which became my second home. And over there, they have a big group where they work on hypoxia and more translational stuff, molecular medicine, attacking cancer from different angles. There are lots of great researchers over there, and I got the opportunity to work in a much more independent way. It was a great experience. I got to learn a lot of other techniques and more the high throughput genomics things. So I and of course kind of deepen my my interest in cancer and realizing how important oxygen is in the way that cancers behave in the body and how it can be used to treat and destroy cancers ultimately. That's the ultimate goal. And so that was a while. That was like, let's see, almost 6 years. And I became a Canadian citizen, something that I'm very proud of. So Canada is like my second home.
Sure.
You
obviously bonded with the place very much.
Yeah, Canada is a great place. Canadians are awesome. So
the listeners on the podcast can't see this because we haven't got video, but
that's
we're talking, and there's a maple leaf there on his desk for the Canadian flag, and there's one on the whiteboard behind him. So there's no doubting the pride in the Canadian citizenship.
Yeah, sure. Very, very proud of that. Yeah, it's a wonderful country. Wonderful people. So over there, we got a bunch of interesting opportunities there to collaborate with clinicians, people that work in radiology, in different types of cancer. Wonderful place. And you know what happened next, right?
So you were recruited across the Atlantic to Dublin, to UCD, as part of the Ad Astra fellowship scheme. Which you started in January of 2020. And it's very much, you know, listening to your story so far, it sounds like the next chapter in your career evolution, really, in Dublin, which is looking at novel mechanisms of hypoxic signaling in cancer. So Greg Semenza's group was very much the driver of HIF-dependent signaling, or hypoxia inducible factor dependent signaling, which is a major component of hypoxia signaling, but it's certainly not the only one. And it sounds very much like you're going in the opposite direction now from the HIF field. So trying to explore the new biology that exists in trying to understand how cancer and tumors respond to low oxygen, but in a HIF independent fashion. Is that right?
That is about right. Exactly. Yeah. So the thing is that, you know, the question is, what do you do after a Nobel Prize is awarded to something that you've been working on, right? So I think that the only thing that you can do is say, well, I have done my own experiments and I know that there is more to it than just HIF. So for the audience, you know, HIF is just the protein that gets accumulated when oxygen is scarce. And then it causes thousands of different effects in the cell, and it is associated with cancers that are more aggressive. So when a type of cancer has less oxygen, it's less difficult to kill, basically, and to stop. So the point is that what we are interested in is to find other sensors in the cell that can help the cancer cell survive. And then, of course, after we discovered those, we're going to try to turn them off. And we have lots of evidence. And of course, I'm working with my collaboration with my wife, Dr. Luana Skito, who is an Ad Astra fellow as well, and that I met in the lab of Greg Semenza. So here's some personal tidbit. So we are a two-person team, and she's a brilliant scientist on her own. And she's more interested in the metastatic part. Yeah, that's the part where it disseminates, when the tumor disseminates from the primary site to a distant site. And it turns out that is the primary cause of death, unfortunately, amongst patients. So in a way, I'm interested in what happens in the primary tumor, what sensors get all tweaked up in the primary tumor, resulting in the dissemination. And she is more interested in stopping the dissemination. So we are like compartmentalized. But the idea is that there are at least, we know already from our preliminary results that there are at least two pathways that are participating on this effect. So when you get rid of HIF, if you attack HIF with a drug, we could make a bold prediction. We can say that all the drugs that are going to target HIF that are in clinical trials now are going to be very effective, but there will be resistance to the drug developed very soon because these other pathways that we are trying to discover how they work in detail are going to be turned on, and the cancer cell is going to come back, and you will get something that you call relapse in the clinic, right? So when the tumor tends to disappear and then it comes back, and unfortunately, when it comes back, it's resistant, it's more difficult to kill. And that's the problem with cancer. We need to find, one thing is to cure cancer, which seems to be very difficult. I'm not saying that it's impossible, because nothing is impossible, But what if we could keep cancers in a chronic stage, like kind of like what we do with patients with HIV, right? So you keep the virus controlled. If you could keep the cancer without growing for 5 decades, that in practice would mean that the person will not die of cancer. To me, I mean, if I think of it from that point of view, it's something that is just as good as curing cancer, like people talk about.
Living with cancer long-term as a potential like a chronic strategy and mm-hmm. preventing it from metastasizing and causing mortality. Yeah. I mean, that sounds like a fascinating area to go and pursue, Sergio. Really wish you the very best of luck in those endeavors going forward. And it sounds like the husband and wife team tackling cancer from different angles definitely sounds like a good multidisciplinary approach that we hope will find success. So it's been probably an unusual time to welcome you to Ireland. So I remember we met probably over a year and a half ago at the start of the Ad Astra Fellowship scheme. And we're very much looking forward to getting set up in the lab and getting into normal life in Ireland. Unfortunately, there's been very little normal life in Ireland since you've arrived. So how challenging has it been to try and integrate, first of all, into a new country and sort of find your way around Ireland and living in Ireland, and secondly, trying to set up your lab and to try and recruit and hire students or postdocs to help you on this scientific quest that you're embarking on?
Yeah, that's a good question. By the way, I will let you know that you threw me a curveball in the job interview when I was applying for the job. I still remember your question. So Owen, you did that. You threw me a very difficult question. I wish I could remember it. You asked me about the clinical implications of using certain type of inhibitors that affect HIF and how that might affect the appearance of cancers in patients with anemia. So just for the record, thank you for that.
I'm glad to be of help. It obviously wasn't too much of a curveball because you're sitting here on the other side of the job interview being appointed. So you must have given a very convincing answer.
I did not drown, fortunately. Anyway, it was a really great question. I'm joking. Yeah, it's been very difficult. I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, I try to take things with humor, but of course, you know, we came in here in January 2020, and then, you know what, weeks later, this whole thing started, the pandemic and the lockdowns. And as you know, that disrupted everything, disrupted the, I guess that you could see the silver lining on it. You know, I managed to get into Ireland right before the doors closed. So that was good, I guess. But then, you know, we couldn't order things to start the lab, you know, reagents, equipment.
Basic things just became impossible, really.
Right. PCR machines, for example, which is a technique that is also used to diagnose COVID. So they completely disappeared. And, you know, I think that the audience knows, very well what I'm talking about. But it was difficult on the science side. And you know, that only makes the work of people that are working on the COVID side of things to do diagnosis in the clinic. It only makes their work more admirable, you know, but it was very difficult. Recruiting people, very difficult as well, because they have problems coming in here. They cannot, the international students, prospective students for the PhD program that we are sponsoring, also have problems coming to see the lab or talk to us in person. It makes it very strange, this whole process of, you know, selecting people through Zoom calls. It's bad. You need to have the personal touch. It's something that really...
It's hard to establish whether you can work with someone or have good professional chemistry without meeting them in person and having that face-to-face chat. Yeah. So yeah, sure. I think most people at this stage have had more than their share of Zoom chats and meetings and interviews than they would care to. So we're having this conversation here in June of 2021, and the future is beginning to look a little bit clearer and more bright. So what are you looking forward to doing in the next 12 months, research wise?
I'm looking forward to actually seeing my colleagues in flesh and blood, you know, in the flesh, you know. I'm looking forward to that. There are many people that I only know through a video screen, so it's that's kind of frustrating. I'm looking forward to getting to work, you know, with all the ideas that we have. We have been able to start doing experiments, but it's been very difficult. Also having the chance to mentor the students, the people that are working in the lab, interact more with people at the Conway, people at UCD at large. Because, you know, I mean, we are very eager to establish all kinds of collaborations here in Dublin and collaborate on anything that has to do with the hypoxia. Actually, it doesn't have to be cancer. I mean, the problem of hypoxia is one of the reasons why I've always been interested in it is because it's so broad, right? I mean, there's practically no disease in a human being that doesn't have a component of low oxygen. I cannot think of one. So I think that, and also, and we have a lot of people here in the Conway that are interesting, yourself, right? So, and different aspects of how oxygen, CO2, and other gases are affecting the function of the body in normal conditions or even in under disease states. So hopefully we will get some data out and start, you know, publishing and applying for grants and all those things. And hopefully things will become more normal and we can get to enjoy, you know, the collegiality that I have experienced even electronically here in arriving at Dublin. I mean, I'm really, really happy with the way people are here. It's a great place. The food is great. The people are great. The city is beautiful, walkable. So, I mean, you, after traveling all over the world, you kind of get tired of big cities and gigantic infrastructure. You know, it's, I mean, and there's a certain advantage in being in a place where you can meet people and where you can walk to places and all the green all over the place. I really love it.
So Dublin's a little bit more like a large village feel than a big city feel. Certainly,
it is a beautiful city.
To some of the big cities that you've been in.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing more of Ireland. Also, you know, I know that there are other places that are great. So that's
It sounds like you've got great plans for the next 12 months ahead. I can just see you building up to go knocking on doors, to door stopping people, to not taking no for an answer for collaborations and different avenues that you're wishing to pursue. So, Dr. Sergio Ray, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast this morning. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation again. And hopefully I'll talk to you soon. In person.
You've been listening to the UCD Conway Institute Class Acts podcast. A big thank you to the Conway Institute researchers for sharing their stories and Dr. Owen Cummins for chatting with them. Subscribe and follow UCD Conway Institute wherever you get your podcasts.